This show is sponsored by Qualitest. Deploy software that you and your customers trust with Qualitest Testing and Business Assurance Services. Learn more about Qualitest at qualitestgroup.com.
Hello, and welcome to the Testing Show. I'm Matt Heuser here live at Agile 2016. I probably shouldn't bang my fist on the table. Talking to a panel of experts about a couple of new and emerging ideas that I hadn't heard before. So we've got Emma Armstrong, all the way from Cambridge, England.
Hi. Yeah, I'm Emma, and I'm a tester, and I work at Willis Towers Watson. And I've been working in the industry for a rather long time, trying to help promote the community that we want to build.
You've had the experience flip, where you go from, I have 7 years of experience, to the kind of, yeah, I've been around.
Yeah, I'm old.
Dan Ashby from Scotland.
Cambridge now.
I can't do Dan Ashby yet. Give me time.
Americans cannot do Scottish accents ever. It's
well,
a rule.
I'll do an American accent. Oh. Yeah, Dan Ashby, global head of testing and a services team, AstraZeneca. Heading up a great testing team there. Less of the hands-on stuff now, although I still do try to talk more about testing to customers and things like that.
And we have Claire Moss, who's local in Atlanta at
hey
Version
y'all.
1.
Welcome to my hometown. Is that southern enough? If you want to find me on the internet, I'm A Clarification. I'm an Agile tester who's been in for over a decade, and that's sort of vague, but also experienced.
And finally, we have Tim Ottinger with Industrial Logic. Welcome to the show, Tim.
Thank you. I suppose, as of this month, about a 37-year veteran of software, having lived through the methodology wars and the case wars and everything else that's fun. I am a consultant and a trainer and a writer and a drone hack and a small aquatic mammal.
And CASE, if you didn't pick up on that, is Computer Assisted Software Engineering.
Yes.
Which was kind of a thing for a while.
Until we learned better.
It didn't work.
Like, no.
That was the only problem with CASE. Before we dive into it, is every single person here a speaker?
Yeah.
So tell me the name of your talk, and if you have slides up, or you're going to put slides up, and we will link to it in the show notes. So, Emma, what were you talking about?
Dan and I were talking together. We're talking about the big agile communication game. Weren't actually talking about testing as such, but great communication is pivotal to good testing.
Yes. Okay.
We managed to squeeze in a model. That was about it with the testing front. But we played some games. Everyone had fun.
Okay. And Claire?
We did two workshops this week. I was co-presenting with Joellen Carter on intentional learning and then with Matt Heuser on an exploratory testing hands-on workshop.
Tim!
Yes.
What are you talking about this week?
Well, I did one solo, which was Agile Practices for Everybody, in which we did a number of games to help people seat an agile mindset and understand the context for practices that we discussed. I also did two duets, I guess. One with Brandon Carlson on unconventional agility and sacred cows. And I also did one with Brian Beecham on the first day, which was about learning from bad examples, why people program bad hypothesis because the examples they learn from are horrible. Nothing testing specific, but I certainly do work in testing and with testers and enjoy that.
So tell us about RWBS.
So the idea of the real world work that we do, anyone who has a job or has an occupation or even a hobby, there's the real part. There's the reason that we do what we do, the thing we get to do when we get to the office, the part we look forward to. The real work we will always dive into with gusto. Then there's this other stuff that you have to do so that people will let you do the real work. And I refer to that as the bureaucratic silliness. So we draw this line. On the one side, we write real work, RW. On the other side says bureaucratic silliness, which is abbreviated BS. And all people have to work with real work and BS. And the BS you can tell from somebody's behavior because it's the stuff they put off to the end, hoping they'll run out of time and not have to do it.
I was reading a book recently called The Phoenix Project. Yeah. In The Phoenix Project, they talk about four types of work. But I can totally associate what you're saying with that as well, because a lot of it is silliness. And actually, in The Phoenix Project, I can't remember what the four types of work were. Changes was one. There was
planned and unplanned, right?
Yeah, planned and unplanned. It kind of feels in each four of those categories, there is silliness, I think. think that's something that I've definitely experienced, a lot of bureaucratic stuff, especially in testing as well, where it's kind of, there's this huge debate going on about terminology and stuff like that as well. We were talking about, for me, I don't care what terms people use, I don't care, it's just the understanding that people have. There is a bit of a battle sometimes. I find it easier being at the top of the chain though, and influencing down, rather than being in the team and trying to influence up.
I refer to that as swimming upstream.
Yeah.
So as a tester, what's the bureaucratic silliness that you have to do? What do you think are some examples of BS for testers?
I think one example would be record keeping that doesn't provide value. Sometimes that manifests as test cases, which are overly detailed and easily outdated, but they're manually maintained.
Yeah, so to test case maintenance. Mm-hmm. So I've worked with many teams, or at least talked to teams, that say things like, we didn't have time to maintain the test cases, and now they're out of date, so we just threw them away. Kind of like, what just happened? And then keep working anyway. So what value do they?
So one of the biggest challenges that I've had to face was when someone that was playing product owner and scrum master, and they pretty much said that they didn't care about testing, all they wanted was minimum viable testing. I almost died. The biggest face palm. I didn't actually know how to respond to that.
I think for me, I've had the exposure where there's the real work of providing the information to the team I'm working on, to provide them consistent information that they can show where we're getting to and the progress we're making. And then there's the bureaucratic silliness where we have to do an extra run just to show management the fastest it can ever be at this moment in time, which doesn't actually relate to the consistent metrics that we're using to show our progress. If you put it in a system with 100 machines, how fast could it ever run? I don't know that the management actually want to see that, but that's what I'm being asked to do, and it's taking my time out to produce something like that. So I'm not sure it's actually meeting a need, but it's something that people think, because they very rarely ask what data people want to see.
So certainly metrics that are hand-gathered and added to a spreadsheet. I've seen, like, one company I worked with, we were supposed to gather these metrics. I forget what spreadsheet we were using, but it was web-based. And you could tell who looked at it, and, like, no one ever did. So I just stopped filling it in, and no one noticed. And time tracking. So my contractors need to fill in their timesheets so they can get paid. And yet, I've got a fantastic one who's brilliant, but you have to remind him to do his timesheets. And, like, you know you want to get paid, right?
I do like your one about timesheets. Because I work with actuaries who charge by the hour, I have to fill in a timesheet even though I'm a developer who gets a fixed salary.
And yeah, so I don't want to... CapEx versus OpEx, I don't care. It's not my problem.
I just want to test software. So that would be bureaucratic silliness for me.
But don't you think bureaucratic silliness also comes into our personalities, depending on the type of personality we are? The line's in a different place.
What blew my mind when Tim explained it to me the first time is that I have gone through periods where I'm demoralized about the work, or I'm in work avoidance, and what I'm doing is checking email. The first thing I do in the morning is checking, trying to find an interruptive event that can make things different to break me out of my pattern. The real work for me at the time was checking email. Well, according to this model, yeah, right? I don't know if you've ever been in work avoidance, but it's not a good emotional, mental place.
Mine was revision avoidance, where my house was the cleanest it had ever been, so I didn't have to study. You procrastinate and do anything but.
You didn't study? Mm-hmm. What were you studying for?
My master's degree.
Oh, sure.
Well, in a lot of teams, strangely enough, and of course, this isn't about a line inside your head, but for a lot of people, the improvement is bureaucratic silliness. So you'll find people who, they have the assigned work, you know, we're supposed to get some things done, but we're also supposed to then improve, you know, improve
your annual goal, your annual goal to move to this way of doing things, to adopt TDD in the year.
Oh, we're going to start doing BDD when we have time.
Right.
We'll do tests first. We're going to start doing Three Amigos meetings after the crunch someday.
Right.
When we have leftover time that we're not using for anything real.
So here's a question. Do you think a lot of the bureaucratic stuff stems from misunderstandings from the intention?
I can't hypothesize. So the reason that I had brought this up was because I had realized that as a change agent, my job is to take useful things from the BS side and make them a part of the daily work. When I would write code and test it, which I still do sometimes, but in the old days, when I'm done with the code, then I'll write the tests. And that tells you where the line was drawn. The real work was the code I'm going to deploy. The tests I write for the code are the BS that I do so that I can write the code.
And Tim, being a programmer, for him, test means unit test.
Yes, strictly right.
And I'm okay with using the term unit test.
And manual test. So we have micro tests that are testing lines of code individually. So when I changed my life was when I went to TDD as a programmer. Now the testing is a part of the real work. And now it has power to transform my practice. But as long as it's on the right-hand side, the BS side of the line, it has no transformative power. And the trick is to move it for each person into the real work, any kind of an improvement. And that's my purpose for that. And also it's self-knowledge, because I'm a long-term pair programmer, pair tester, pair ops, or whatever we do, pair coaching. And I thought that I loved pairing on everything. And then I found myself, I looked back at my time for a week, and I realized I had put off pairing with somebody until the last 2 days of the week. And I thought, why did I delay that? And it dawned on me, this particular work and pairing with this person, I had pushed away from the real work into the BS side. And I wasn't valuing that as a natural part of my work, which taught me maybe I don't believe as strongly as I thought I believed.
So BS to me sounds like a negative thing. Why would it be a great idea to move the BS into the real work?
Well, remember, it's a mental attitude. Let's say you have to do exploratory testing, but you also have to do some regression testing. Can we push the regression testing to right before we release? Well, yeah, if it's not the real work. But if it is the real work, if it should be the real work, then we need to move it into its correct place.
So you can say, I believe that X has value. But if you're not acting like it has value, because for some emotional reason, you've considered it BS. You're acting like it's BS. No matter how much you say it, and you really believe it when you say it, I know I need to do X, but I just don't want to do it, so you push it off. If X actually was valuable, then by pushing it off, you're decreasing your performance.
But on the other hand, there are things that we see as the real work. So I have, in the past, spent way too much time in marketing online things when I had stuff to do. So what I had done is I had put the wrong things in the real work side that probably should have been pushed to the BS side. It really wasn't that important for me to do that. But I had put too much value on it. And with work avoidance, you could say, well, my job is to be available and responsive to my peers right now. That's the real work, because that other thing that's kind of bureaucratic silliness, I don't want to engage in that.
But that's always going to be from your perspective, right?
Yes, so yes, individuals.
Your bureaucratic sort of BS work might be someone's really valuable, important.
Right.
That they need you to do, right?
Yeah, so, and that connection is tightened, it becomes real work.
And I think we get this incongruence between what we really genuinely believe and how we act.
Do you need to get team cohesion then on what's the real work and what's the bureaucratic silliness?
I think that everyone will have a different perspective. Sharing those might help us to determine what the team's real work is. But I think there probably are activities that are not equally valuable to everyone on the team, or even everyone in the larger organization. I mean, why else would we think of it as silliness? Surely someone wouldn't ask us to do things that are silly and wasteful, right?
Isn't there an element that some of the stuff we're not actually necessarily asked to do, we just think we are supposed to do them?
It comes back to the sort of what you were talking about with the spreadsheet online. I had a very similar story where they were asking for test reporting via Excel, and I accidentally sent them a blank document, and they didn't notice. And I noticed a week later, so then I went back. I had a good rapport with them, so I went back saying, oh yeah, how was that test report? And they were like, yeah, it was good. And I was like, it was blank. So it's kind of like, that felt like one of those tasks that you were kind of just talking about, where it's just ceremony, because it's been done for so long and it's never questioned. And then eventually when I questioned them, they were like, oh, well, there's too many words in it. It's not useful for us anymore. But it used to be point of thing.
I think you're right about establishing habits in a certain context, and then not recognizing when they lose their value, when they become less appropriate, given the changes that have happened, whether it's team disruption or you take a consistent team and put them onto new work. All of those environmental things that made that strategy successful may no longer allow it to be successful.
Right. And when waste takes the wrong side of the line, then you get functionaries. And a functionary has this function, and that's the reason they live. I update the spreadsheet. My job is to be the JIRA groomer, you know, supporter. My job is to, you know, whatever the case is, it's wasteful, but it's on the wrong side of the line. For somebody, that's the real work and alignment stuff. So you asked about the team. I think alignment's really crucial here. But if we don't recognize where the line is, we don't know that we're in misalignment.
There's at least two things I see here. One being, if it actually is BS and it's waste, and we correctly identify it as BS and waste, we do it last. We do it to satisfy some weird stakeholder in an odd department who insisted that we create this report. Sometimes you can just get rid of that stuff. You can go to management. How are you going to hit that deadline? Not doing this anymore.
So to spin this around into testing, this is quite common with some misconceptions around about what testing is. And I've worked in companies where the people at the top have said, get rid of testers. They would see what the testers do is being the BS work. And then they're trying to implement a strategy that's kind of based on misunderstanding. If we don't have alignment, and we recognize that we don't have alignment, is there always going to be a problem with authority?
Oh, I hope not.
Our real work is someone in authority's BS.
Yes,
what you're getting at?
Basically, yeah.
It sounds like Emma.
I think you also have the scenario where you could have two people in testing who have a different approach. So one person believes that you can do session charter-based testing to replace the traditional regression testing that was there, and then they have conflicting versions of what's real work and what's on the other side of the line.
Yeah.
I think Tim making us aware that there is this line and it is individualistic, and if we talked about where it is for people, it might really help us have the conversation about why it's defined there.
I guess what I'm trying to really get to, is it really a people problem?
I think all problems are people problems.
Of course, yeah, but it's kind of, there's always, it feels as if there's always going to be a disconnect somewhere.
There's disconnects between people where what I think is real work you think is BS.
Yeah.
And I think there's disconnects within yourself where I seem to be acting as if this thing which I espouse is valuable, but I put it off as long as I can. What's that about? How can I get it to be fun again?
I think that Tim mentioned that you're framing the information in your head about, I categorize this as real work and not BS, or vice versa, and that determines part of my motivation toward it. But you also do have that feedback of the actual behaviors and how they correspond to the thinking that you believed you had, whether you really are recognizing it or not.
Yeah, how you actually vote with your time. And it's a very interesting thing because it really is internal first. Most organizational dysfunction, I will posit, and I'm willing to be contradicted, comes from misalignment and fear of misalignment. Why is it that you must have permission to do your job? Well, because I'm afraid you might not be aligned with me and you might be doing things I don't want you to, or for reasons that don't align with my reasons. I want to get this project done. You might be amusing yourself. That's not aligned. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to put in rules that hold you in alignment, where the alternative is, by the way, that we can align. But that would require us to interact and know each other, which works great until you're managing 5,000 of your least close friends.
I think also, though, in order to be in alignment, you have to be vulnerable and admit that you might have misinterpreted something. That may not feel very comfortable.
At Lean Coffee this morning, Michael Tardick has brought up, what is the risk in being open?
Mm.
And I think it's exactly that, it's vulnerability. And the one thing I said, I was asked to do some security testing once, and I just put my hand up and said, I've just got to say, security testing is not my forte. I can do SQL injection attacks, I can do a threat model, but it's not my forte, it's not my area of expertise. But actually admitting that made me look like I was incapable of doing my job, rather than being honest that it was not my forte.
Do you think people really took it that way? Ooh, Emma doesn't know how to do this check on the checklist. Of the 16 things, she can only do 15 of them.
Yeah.
That's too bad. I've worked in organizations where that would be, well, I'm really good at that, let me help you, boom. Not many.
but I will acknowledge the risk. And as a consultant, I come into a lot of organizations and I have to admit that I don't know their domain. And it's been the most growth engendering behavior change of the past 20 years that I have to come in and say, you know what, I really don't understand pharmaceuticals very well. I'm going to have a guide. And by the way, I've never really programmed in Scala before. How can we work together? It's interesting, though, because in that you learn to model the vulnerability of it and the honesty of it, but it is brutally hard when you know that they're paying a lot of money to have you here, that you have any deficiencies at all. It's peeling off armor, and it's very difficult.
I would say that's not just for consultants. I'm a new employee, there are a lot of things I don't know. I just taught a session on acquiring skills and assessing your own ability, and I put a big slide up that was tweeted about how I'm new to DevOps. It's something I'm interested in, it's something my employer's interested in, but to admit that I don't know doesn't feel great, except that I have hope that I can improve that.
This is a really great place for me to mention that this isn't something that's rigorously studied, this real work to bureaucratic silliness line. This is really more like observational humor. There is no study behind this. There is no science behind this. It does seem to have both explanatory and predictive value, but there is no rigor. So this idea we're discussing is just an idea, and I want you to make sure you know that, that this isn't me as a scientist delivering something that's well studied and known. Mm-hmm. This is us kicking around and riffing.
Tell us about relevance ratio in the time we have left.
Oh, okay. So this is another bit of observational humor about developers, but it was interesting to me to see that some people, when they're in cubicles or offices, are miserable beings, and they love an open floor space. And then you get people who are in pods or open plan, and they're just miserable. And I started wondering, none of these people were wrong, and I believe in placing curiosity above judgment. So I started off with, well, those people were wrong. And then I recognized, oh, that's not curiosity. So I started digging in. So here is my theory as observational humor. There is a relevance ratio. So you take a look at the total amount of information around you. Conversations, pictures, scrolling screens, etc. And then that's the denominator. The numerator that goes on top is how much information relevant to the job you're doing right now. If you were going to try to sit down and do some really good test strategy and really good a good assessment of user experience in the middle of the keynote conversation yesterday morning as everybody was clapping and cheering and laughing and being shocked, that would have been harder. It would have been harder yet to do it in the hallway with everybody passing by because most of the information is irrelevant. So to bring this back to my original case, if we're sitting in a pod and we're all doing work together, it's almost idyllic. But if we all do solo work, then silent offices are almost perfect. The information flow and the relevance of information matches to the job we're doing. On the other hand, if we have cubicles and we sit with people who are also testers, but they're not testers on our project, the relevance is low, the information is high. It's a dystopian environment. So it's really about if you're with your peers, with your tribe, or if you're away from your tribe.
So I think to restate this, it's about signal to noise. Like which
yes.
part of it do you need to know right now? And that may change over time. What I find is that if I am in a shared environment, opportunities arise that I didn't anticipate. So if I have irrelevant information at this moment, and yet it's there, I may pick up on it and change what I'm doing to find out more about this information that didn't seem important until it was available to me.
I totally agree. And I've got a prime example when I used to be the sole tester in a company, and there was a lot of developers. A lot of the time I would test and I would eavesdrop on conversations. So because people hadn't really worked with a tester, I was their first tester, I was their only tester, they would tend to leave me out of conversations and meetings. But their conversations were around their desks, so I could just get involved anyway, right? If that conversation was taken into a separate location, it would be much harder for me to get involved. And as part of the eavesdropping, I was able to point out lots of assumptions that they were making as part of discussing the stories and things like that. And then eventually, they discovered the value in inviting into the conversations. When we took on more testers, they got invited straight away because they saw the value of having them there. But working in silos, like in the cubicles and things, I think I would really struggle with that.
It sounds like you were trying to get a literal seat at the table.
Yeah.
And in order to do that, you had to know what was going on around you that hadn't been directly, your presence hadn't been requested, but you saw that something was going on and you had an option whether to join in or not. So sharing that information about when communication's happening is an opportunity to make a decision about it without necessarily inserting yourself.
I've noticed a slight side of that, though, is the people's personal preference. So I'm a people person. I will get up and walk even upstairs to talk to someone because I would rather talk to them. However, we have people in our office who might be working on their own at that point, or they're working on something what they deem is extremely complicated, and therefore they want to get into the flow, and any noise from any of us around them actually irritates them to the extent that we have now a separate office which is a flow zone that people can go into. One of them sent an email one time saying, I decided to work from home for the natural quiet. And I know I'm one of the culprits, I'm one of the laughers in the office. So, but the, for me, if I don't have that eavesdropping, I can't keep up with the guys. But it's an almost fine line between rudeness. Someone will say something and I'll turn around and say, oh, that's that. And it speeds up a solving of a situation. But it's close to being rude because you are eavesdropping outside your conversation zone.
I'm keen to hear your perspective from a developer point of view, because I work with a lot of developers that straight away stick their canned headphones on, right, and want to be in that silo. But most of the testers that I've worked with want to work in a group. Do you see a difference there with the testers that you work with compared to developers?
One of the things that I have a tendency to do is I tend to teach pair programming and mob programming. I am, first off, an introvert with a big capital I in bold and italics, and possibly in a separate font. But I have recognized the value of working with people in groups. Now, if I'm expected to do solo work, then flow requires me to get rid of all of the distractions, because I also have a hummingbird brain that will flit from flower to flower. So I have to lock down if I'm going to be doing solo work, and I really got to get it done. In fact, my solo speech, I had to reach some serious isolation to really go through my solo talk. And then I had to come out and vet it with people. So in that flow, you're starved of signal other than one thing. So the focus is really great. When they go put the headphones on, they're in a different room and they're in their own headspace. But I find that solo work is just generally not a good idea. It's almost never the right thing to do. You want solo work when the outcome depends upon it being your personality and your voice, which is really not the case with programming. Programming is something that we write to each other. On the other hand, people have expected programmers to be cats. So they don't really collaborate. They don't really interoperate. Each one does its own thing. They couldn't give a fig about each other. They'll fight over food and toys. And I think that that expectation has developed a generation of programmers that haven't yet learned to collaborate. So my answer is no, brain.
I found it interesting over the years working with predominantly academic coders. And we were talking the other day, there's different types of developers in the sense you've got the software engineers, you might have the architects, but sometimes you do have the programmer, coder, the academics who believe that they're trained to work solo, predominantly in academia. And so having done their PhDs, etc., that is what is learned behaviour. And getting them outside of that is much more tricky than when the new graduates come out of university, etc. They're much more open to the mobbing, the pairing, and actually getting people involved.
It's almost as if working solo has taken an ethical dimension there, because you do your own work and you get your own work done. And when it takes that ethical dimension, that moves being alone to the real work side and interacting to the BS side.
Mm.
That may be a factor of, in the academic setting, you're being evaluated individually. So if you are doing primarily paired work or you're achieving flow with others, how do people look at your performance? So that kind of goes back to assessing productivity.
So who's speaking at what next?
Agile Iowa.
Des Moines?
Introducing, yes, in Des Moines.
I'll be in Des Moines.
I will be introducing Modern Agile there.
Okay. I'll be talking about agile testing there. Jocker.
I have no more commitments this year.
Congratulations.
Apart from tomorrow, where you need to go up at 9 a.m. and do that.
Yeah, my session got picked for OpenJam on quality testing as a service.
I think I'm free till September, and then I've got my first keynote. It's at the National Software Testing Conference North in the UK, and there's a few old school mindsets. So my talk's entitled "How Ignorant Are You?"
And I just remembered, I've just been accepted for Lean Agile Scotland. So
oh, nice.
If you're going to be there, I would see you there.
Yeah, I'll try and be there.
Okay.
Yeah.
In September, we have the Stack Conference in Atlanta. So I'm on board there, and I anticipate doing a workshop.
If you listen to this show a lot, you know I'm all over the place. You know where I'm going to be. But we'll be coming back in 2 weeks to do another podcast. Thank you guys so much. I owe you one. Have a Hershey's chocolate bar.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it, guys.
And
great.
Hershey's needs to call you. We're looking for a sponsorship here.
So our real sponsor is QualiTest. We don't talk about them enough on the show. They do a lot of fantastic things. Check out the website. They're the reason this show is here. And if you have staff aug needs, they're the number one pure play software test company. And I endorse their work. Thanks.
Cool. Thanks.
Bye, y'all.
Thank you for listening to The Testing Show, sponsored by Qualitest. For more information, please see www.qualitestgroup.com. Do you have questions? Or is there a topic or an idea you'd like to have covered? Please email us at thetestingshow@qualitestgroup.com, and we will answer questions we receive on air.